This is the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast with Gary Taylor.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast. Hope you are well. We are in spring, and hopefully the sun will be out and you start enjoying your Astons. And if you don't have an Aston, perhaps you'd like to consider buying one from McGurk Performance Cars, because that is where I am today. And I'm delighted to have John McGurk with me. Hello, John.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us here on the podcast. You've also supported the Aston Martin Heritage Trust over the past three festivals, haven't you, I believe?
Yeah, always a great event. The Heritage Trust put on a wonderful event for everyone that's there, for the dealer sort of section, and for the owners as well. They're a good event to attend.
Thanks very much, Phil. We've got another one coming this year, so you'll probably be hearing from Sue, our operations manager, to encourage you to come. She's pretty good on these.
So. Yeah.
Anyway, how long have you been going for, John?
22 years.
22 years,
yeah.
Which is probably as long as the VH platform, isn't it?
Yes, slightly longer than. So 2002 we started, March 2002, and the DB9 started essentially in 2004.
That's it.
Yeah. The beginning of the company initially was buying and selling a host of different cars. My background was, I just stepped out of the Ferrari network. So, and at the time, Greypool in Loughborough, that it was this beautiful, quaint little dealership tucked away in the middle of town, and there were never enough Ferraris to go around, so Aston Martin was our next sort of target, if you like, from a business point of view. And so, yeah, I mean, all the way through the late 90s, we were buying and selling the DB7s and the Vanquish and the V500s and all this sort of thing. When I stepped out of that, Aston Martin was quite a big part of what I was doing. And then DB9 sort of came along with the baby Vantage in the background, Aston banging the drum about that. And I just grabbed hold of it and off we went, really. And I think that the commercial decision for me at the time was that there were lots of Ferrari specialists around that had been there forever and a day, but there weren't any Aston specialists per se. It was all the classic, the guys that have been there and done it, and they're still the past masters of the old classic cars. And I was being asked more and more about, can you get me a DB9? Can you get me a Vantage? And this, that, and the other. And it just kind of fell into it, I suppose, as sometimes you do. And off we went. And not back since, really.
So you chose to be on the VH platform era. Are there any cars that you feel have been, over the years, have been underappreciated?
Yeah, I think, for me, the obvious car is the Repeat, because I'm a huge Repeat fan, and I do go on about it a little bit. But it was, for me, it was the car that wasn't, I say marketed correctly. It's not my place to say, but what I'm getting at is that they didn't shout about it enough or correctly. And I think that the dealer network at the time didn't really understand how good a car it actually was. And I think that the problem was that they'd actually built a car, especially with the Repeat S. The Repeat S was a car that was actually better than the Vanquish. And I think that there's a hierarchy issue there, because the Vanquish is supposed to be top of the tree, and all of a sudden everyone's thinking, hang on a minute, this Repeat S we've just got on, it's absolutely amazing. It does 200 miles an hour, and it does this, and it does that, and it's got four doors.
Why do you think it was amazing? Because I read somewhere that they thought that the longer wheelbase,
the handling's
just transformed the handling.
Yeah, you can hustle those cars, because I would, if I was going on a track day, right, I'd rather run the Repeat S than a Vanquish. It's been more fun. You can hustle them like a sports car. The handling on them, I think, is great. It's surprisingly good, and it's the overall speed. It's the handling. It's more diverse. It's the only car that, you know, as you say, it's got four doors. I mean, I've had two of them historically, and I've just bought myself another one. I put 40,000 miles on both cars, you know, two children, my wife, we're all getting the car, and we're going to Cornwall or wherever we're going to go for a week with all the luggage. And this is when we had pushchairs to put in the car as well. I mean, it was a no-brainer for me. In fact, I spoke to a customer a couple of weeks ago, and I'm actually we're going to have to do some sort of article with him, because this gentleman, he bought a Repeat from us Oh, he must have had the car 10 years. He's done 100,000 miles in the car.
Oh, good grief.
Most of it's around Europe. He comes to us every November for the winter tyres to go on, and he takes the car down to Austria. He goes skiing. He goes up the Alps with the car and all the rest of it. He's been everywhere. He's done 100,000 miles, and he absolutely adores this car. But what was always a defining... I say defining moment for me was that whenever I was invited to go to the factory at Gaydon, and you'd pull into the front car park, the VIP kind of car park at the front, where all the directors parked their cars, all drove Rapide S. They were just lined up. David Richards from ProDrive, he had a Rapide S. Everybody, all the people behind the scenes, they all drove that car because it was the best car that they made. And now, you know, it was what was a, you know, almost a £200,000 car. And they're now £70,000.
Yes, yes.
So you can't ignore it. There's very little of them on the market. But what I can tell you is that today, if you went onto the market today and you wanted to buy a Rapide or a Rapide S, I would categorically state that today I know there's 13 Rapides and probably the same number in S's on the market. Now that's got to tell you something about how rare the car is. It's a desirable car. And they should hold their money pretty well. And they're so cheap. I mean, they start at sort of £35,000. That's a lot of car. That's a lot of car. There's so much going for them. But for me, the handling, I mean, I always put winter tyres on mine, always drove it through the winter. No problem whatsoever. In fact, an amusing story just here at the bottom of the Brockhampton Lane. When we turn left to go out of Kyneton, there's the hills at the moment, must be 45 degree sort of gradient. And I remember coming out of here one afternoon, it was snowing and the snow was really starting to come down, and we were all sitting here thinking it's time to leave because we're not going to get home. And I got to the bottom of the road, turned left, and there were cars in the ditches either side and the Rapide with some winter tyres. I just went straight up, straight home, and off I went. I'm a big fan of that car.
It was a derivative of the DB9. Do you consider the DB9 the slightly moving into heritage?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. So it's my understanding that when the cars got to 20 years of age, that there should be some sort of heritage association.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I was expecting this year or soon as for the DB9 to move into the heritage side of Aston Martin. To join the Mark 1 Vanquish and so on and so forth. I haven't heard about any, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. I think it ought to, but equally, it feels like the V8 Vantage, it feels like it's still a bit young and fresh for it to become heritage.
Yes, it does. I think the market tends to decide, and I think if the, well, we've had DB9, we've had DB11, now we've had DB12, and I think probably the DB9 has just been pushed down slightly,
yeah,
into the background.
It's pushing it into that classic car world a little bit more, isn't it? And I think that for me now, when we're looking at those early DB9s, you know, the 2004, 2005, I do look at those cars now and think, oh, they're starting to age a little bit, because there's so many newer variants in front of it that look, you know, just sharper, later design and all the rest of it. And equally from a servicing point of view, the maintenance of them's changed completely. So you can pretty much throw away the original servicing plan of when the cars were new, because now it's almost not really that relevant. So many more things to look at and look after. And as cars get older, and it's a 20-year-old car, you do treat them a little bit differently. So for that to move into the heritage side of things, I think that's the right. It's the right time for it. It looks like the car of that age. It looks like it's time for it to kind of head into that sort of direction.
I think you're right. But having said that, when you start looking at the younger variations of the DB9, you start looking at DB9 GT, and we saw one outside in that. What's that?
Chiltern. Yeah. Rare car.
That looks nice.
Yeah, beautiful.
You couldn't say that. That still looks like a modern car.
Yeah, it does. It's so sharp. And because of the colour, it makes it look more modern, more attractive. You know, Astons are green, like Ferraris are red and so on and so forth. And that just looks, it's a one-of-one specification car. And if I could fill the showroom with cars in that colour, it would be a much easier job for me.
What do you think is the best color combo? What's the market looking for these things? Is it still traditional colors, silvers and greens?
The word is color, right? So for me at the minute, colors are good, because there's so many cars that are black and silver and gray and variations thereof. So we love different. We've got a Madagascar orange Vantage that I've just bought in the showroom. We've got the Chilton Green DB9 GT. Colours are great. Blue, the blue Vanquish we bought yesterday, midnight blue. So I love to have things that are different. We had a yellow Vantage at the back end of last year. We've had a yellow DB11, you know, just different colours. I'm never put off by different. In fact, quite the opposite. I'd rather have things that are a bit more off the wall, I think. More desirable, it's rarer, you know, why not, really?
Go to the Vanquish, because the Vanquish was, I'd say, a DB9 derivative, but I think that's been unfair to the Vanquish. Do you consider that?
So Mark II Vanquish, I think, okay, so we're always talking...
Because that's another sleeper, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, the Mark II Vanquish, alongside the Rapide, will be, I'm going to stick in my neck out, but I think that will be the car that in 10 years' time, everyone's going to turn around and say, should have bought one of those. Should have bought one of those when they were the price that they were. The Mark II Vanquish is such an exciting car. When you look at the range of the V8 platform cars, the Mark II Vanquish is just so different. You know, they look at the back of the car, the lights are different, the spoiler on the boot, all the rest of it. But the way the panels are pressed, the lines down the side of the car, the carbon, of course, and the interior was just that little bit more modern at that time in 2013. I think that will be the car at some point that everyone is going to say, we need to have one of those in the garage. Rapide as well, because I mean, the rarity value of the Rapide will carry that through, no doubt. But honestly, it's wonderful. The noise that it makes is slightly different, but everything about the car is different. And, you know, we'll have people that come into the showroom and say, oh, is that a DB9? Or is that a Virage? Or is it a this? Or is it that? Oh, they all look the same. I'm not sure. But you never get that. I mean, because we've got 35 of the things all sat next to each other, and they're probably all in grey. But when but the Mark II Vanquish is the car that everyone goes, oh, that's different. And it is. And it just looks so Aston. It's so Aston Martin. It's beautiful. And the noise that it makes and all the rest of it, that's why it was the flagship of, you know, of the range, and probably why it was the Rapide was downtrodden as a result of it.
Going back to the DB9, we had the DB9, and then we had from development of that was the DBS, and that probably was below the Vanquish, yes?
Yep.
Yeah. And in between those, we had the Virage.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
I said that in a kind of a negative. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
I was going to ask your opinion on the Virage, and I think I've really got it.
No, it's not.
It's actually a lovely looking car.
Yes, no, it's not. I've got nothing negative to say about it. I mean, I think from everyone's point of view, from my point of view, the Virage was a bit of a cock up. Because it should have just been badged a DB9, and that was it. And of course, it out came this Virage, and everyone went, well, that's a DB9. It's not a Virage. And then and consumers, the public, were looking at it saying, well, I don't understand. What is it?
Well, so it's supposed to be a harder version of the DB9, but a softer version of the DBS, wasn't it?
It wasn't translated. And that's not enough. That's not enough of a difference to rebadge a car completely, I don't think. And really, it should just have been, who am I to say, but it should have been just a facelift of it. And I think, and I don't know, but I can only imagine that, you know, they were kind of eight or 9 months into it, and they looked at each other and thought, actually, this isn't working, we're going to pull it. And they just went and did something different, I think. But so the Virage is a difficult one, because there are people that consider it to be it's a rare car because it is a Virage, and because there's a limited number of cars for a year. But then you'd look at it and think, well, actually, wouldn't you rather have a DB9, because you've got a little bit more horsepower with the DB9, you've got the flip tail boot, you've got this, that, and the other, and it's a bit more of a known quantity on the marketplace, I think. So for people that are, you know, pushing themselves to spend that kind of money on a car, would you go for the car that it might be rare in your eyes, but then isn't the DB9 actually better? And I don't know. So we deal with people that it's their own opinion, no right or wrong with it. And people will just go for, you know, whatever they think is right. But it's the Virage is it's a difficult car, because there's not many. It's not the obvious choice. So if you sit up one morning and think, I want to buy a V12 Aston Martin, do you think about the Virage, or you're always going to think about DB9?
DB9.
Yeah. So we find that the Virage is the needle in the haystack, and you've got to wait for that person that's actually looking and they specifically want.
Do you think that's the case? They're going to be looking for a Virage.
Oh, yeah.
Or they're going to come in for a DB9 and said, I like that DB9. And you say, well, actually, that's a Virage.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, sometimes that's more to do with they'll look at the car, a car because it's got a different color combination. Yeah. What's that? Oh, is that a DB9? And then you have the virage conversation. And of course, at that point, you say, well, actually, it's quite a rare car. It's only made for a year and so on and so forth. And people will either fall in love with that or not. And, you know, it's you're almost splitting hairs with it to a degree. But the virage, for a lot of people, they think it's a very special thing. It's a very rare thing, which it is. But there'll be people that say, well, actually, I'd rather have a DB9. I think it looks a little bit better and it's got this and it's got that. And it's personal preference. No right or wrong with any of it, I don't think.
Growing the passion, sharing the stories. The Aston Martin Heritage Podcast.
You mentioned Vantage because I want to get onto Vantage. The early one were 4.3s.
Yep.
How long did they last? I think it was about 3 years.
2008 was the run out. Yeah.
Okay. So what's the market like on the 4.3?
Oh, very good.
Is it? Yeah.
I think that it always has been because when they first came out, it was always the target audience that bought that car when they first came out was the city trader in London. You know, because it was the young lad doing well for himself and wanted the latest Aston Martin. That was the car. And still now, that's still the case where, you know, they are now 30-something thousand pounds. But there's always somebody that's doing well for themselves and they want to celebrate that and they want to go buy an Aston Martin and they want a tungsten with black 4.3 litre Vantage.
Now that's a lot of car. Good, it's a lot of money, but good value for money. 30 grand for an entry level Aston Martin. That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. And that's. I mean, you know, obviously, over the last 12 months, we've had interest rates, which have made a massive difference on the market across the board for all the car market. But all of a sudden, you know, people now are feeling a little bit more confident with where we're going to be this year with interest rates. They understand their outgoings, they know where they're at, and everyone's sort of now actually stepping back into the arena and saying, actually, no, I'm comfortable with that and I can afford one of those now. So the prices that have dipped and across the board, it was 20% depreciation at the back end of last year. It's starting to find its feet again. So that's encouraging.
Okay. So going back to the 4.3, when they first come out, I was in very fortunate position to be given a press car. I thought it had a lovely drive. There was criticism. I didn't have much torque. He had to keep stirring it. I didn't find it as a problem. I'm not a professional test driver at all. But the 4.7 addressed the issues, didn't it?
Yeah. The thing I always find about, you know, articles that are written. So let's say that, you know, the journalist guys that drove the car, they're used to driving a whole manner of cars. It's what they do. Whereas Mr. Smith off the street who knows no different and what have you gets in it and just absolutely loves it. And everyone's just got to make their own opinion about that sort of thing. The cars had always got plenty of go. Yes, the 4.7 had that more, that better mid-range. And yeah, and that was great. But in today's marketplace, people will weigh up, do you want to buy a low mileage 4.3 that's done, say, 20,000 miles, or do you want to buy a 40,000 mile 4.7? So in today's marketplace, they don't turn around and say, oh, I've got to have the 4.7 because it's got that mid-range. Today, it's all about what's the best car I can buy. You know, which car's been well maintained, you know, and mileage is always king. So it's always that low mileage car. So people will still choose the 4.3 over the 4.7.
Did I see a 4.3 downstairs, a silver one?
In the workshop, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I'll tell you what I like about the 4.3. Sorry to bang on about it. I think it's because they're pure. There's no adornments. There's no wings. There's no splitters. They are just the pure form of Aston Martin. I think that's for me. I think that's why they appeal. It's not until you get later on in the Vantages that they start sprouting bits off the car. You know,
big wings and things. Wings. No, you know, when that car came out, when 2005, when that car arrived on the scene, it was jaw dropping. It was a huge success. Huge success, that car.
Same with Advantage. The Vantage spun off all sorts of variations. We have Vantage S, we have AMR, we have V12 Vantages, we got Roadsters. What do you feel is the sweet spot in the range, if it's possible, one or two cars in the Vantage range?
Okay, in no particular order, GT8.
GT8.
Okay, the GT8 is, I think, is one of the most wonderful examples of the Vantage that's been built. It is, I think a lot of people look at it and get confused that it's some sort of track whiz car. Mm. And it could be, but it's not. It's just a really, really, really good road car. And you can have the wings and things and whatever you do or don't want with them. But I think that the way they drive is really good. Really great car, that. So that's good. That'd be my first pick. And the values of those have done incredibly well, and they're still doing well. The Vantage S, really popular. When that came out, all the carbon, a little bit extra horsepower, the different trim on the interior, the seats, and still is now for us, that's a really good, a good and desirable car. The N400s, it's always been the limited editions.
Yes.
You know, the N400, that was a really popular, and it is a popular car. The N420, N430, you know, all those limited edition cars, they all had something extra about them to attract the general public into buying one. But I mean, the GT8 is a different level in terms of price. I think that the Vantage S is great. I think the V12. The V12 is an animal, yeah. And I think, but I think going forward, again, at some point, the values of those cars have always been really, really steady, and that'll be one to keep an eye out on.
Do you think so? Do you think the V12 Vantage is probably too much? You say it's a bit of an animal.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's a handful, but in a nice way. That car originally was designed for a 4.3 V8, which in itself is a big motor, let alone a 6-litre V12. And I remember when I first drove one, and you put your foot down on the throttle and think, my word, that's got a lot of go. It's got a lot of go. The Astons now, the DBS Superleggera, I mean, that's just a ridiculously fast car. But no, the Vantage thing, I think that the special edition cars are always good and always desirable.
The service history of Aston Martin. So how important is it? You look at buying guides and magazines and make sure it has the stamps and it has to come through a main dealer. I question that, because every time I've banged a car in for sale, nobody looks at the damn service history.
We talked a minute ago about DB9s and heritage and what have you. History tells us, and we know, we've just gone through since 2008 this massive rise in classic cars and everyone's a collector and, you know, you've got to have this, that and the other. We now know that the best cars fetch the best price. So when people are buying a DB9 now, and let's say it's only a £30,000 car for argument's sake, when you come to sell that car, the service history of that car is going to be absolutely crucial. So at that point, you've got two choices. You can either go to the main dealer network or you can go to the independents, what have you. The independents, we know that on DB9s that the Aston Martin servicing schedule that they designed back in 2004 is no longer that applicable, because it's a 20-year-old car and there's a whole load of other things to worry about. So, and we know that. It's what we do. It's what we look at. If you have a car and let's say you only do, 1,000 miles or 2,000 miles a year, and let's say you've owned that car for 10 years, and every year you say to yourself, oh, actually, I've only done 1,500 miles in the car this year. Let's just have an annual service. And okay, so an annual service, really, translation is, it's an oil change. Well, if you just do that for 10 years and nothing else, you're not going to have a good service history, because you're missing out on all of the other aspects of things that need to be looked at. So, for example, we had a car here last year. The guy was new to us and came along and said, I want an annual service. Right, okay. Well, what servicing have you had before? And he showed us the book, been stamped by the dealers, da-da-da-da-da, all the way through. And you look at it and think, oh, that looks very good in the service book. But it's all about the detail. So then the questions are starting about, well, when do you last have air filters? I'm not sure. When do you last have a diff oil change? I'm not sure. When have you last had, and it goes on and on and on. So, if I'm going to go now today, and let's say I'm going to go and buy a DB5 for argument's sake, and the service history, we're not looking at a book, we're looking at receipts, and I'm going to have a spreadsheet of tick boxes that I want to make sure that car has had done. And with the DB9s and the Vantages, it's going to go the same way. So it's all going to your car will command the best price if you've maintained it as thoroughly as you possibly can. What we would do is take that car in and pull it all apart, pull all the air filters out, pull the pollen filter out, and we're looking at the car. And then we're going to go back to say, actually, we've assessed your car and it needs X, Y, and Z. And I'll send you a photograph of your air filter. And I'll send you a photograph of how your new air filter will look, and then you'll understand the difference, because your air filter's black. And yes, you've only done 1,500 miles a year for the last 5 years, but your car can't breathe, your engine can't breathe properly. So it just becomes a bit more in-depth. And I mean, diff oil changes on DB9s, absolutely crucial to do that every 2 years. And when the car was new, Aston thought every 4 years was the right way to go. But now we know, after all this time, that having it done every 2 years will just mean it keeps the plates lubricated in the diff and stops them sticking together. And you know, we're now refurbishing diffs because they're grinding because the plates are worn and so on and so forth. So there's a lot to look at. But I think that if these cars become heritage classic, then for me, when I'm selling one of these cars in the future, I want to present it as the best example of a DB9 that there is on the market today. So I'm hoping that if the cars are accepted as a heritage, as part of Aston Martin Heritage, that we can have A heritage certificate from you guys, and B, we'd love to be able to have some sort of certificate of originality where we're saying this DB9 is exactly as it was when it left the factory. Everything about the car is correct. It is box perfect. Beautiful example, sir. Here you go. Look at the service history. Look how well maintained it's been. And all you're doing is giving as much confidence to the buyer as you possibly can.
I was intrigued and pleasantly surprised that all your stock you own.
Yes.
You don't, not on commission.
No, I mean, I make the odd exception to the rule, but no, we own the stock. Yeah, and hopefully that sort of translates through. So yeah, so if I'm if we've spent enough time looking at it and I'm happy that I bought it, it's my car, and I'm passing it on to somebody else, and I'm going to warrant it for a year and so on and so forth. It's as much confidence as I can give, really. But I just prefer to, you know, I'm a businessman. I prefer doing my business in that way. I've got complete control over what I do. You can make instant decisions.
If it's on commission, they've offered a price. You've got to ring to sell it.
Yeah, it's toing and froing, backwards and forth, a lot, and you're burning more time. I want to make sure that when I buy a car, it comes in, we prepare it, we make it lovely, and it's ready to go. Rather than someone saying, "Can you sell my car for me?" and I say, "Well, yes, but you need to paint the front, and you need to do this, and you've got carbon damage." There. Oh, we'll do that when we sell it. Well, no, because you need to do that now. It's just important that everything's as beautiful as it possibly can be, and it's all about impressions.
Now, you have started a series of videos running your Aston Martin, haven't you? I think there was, what was the most recent one you done?
What have we done?
Water, was it?
Yeah, we did. We did one about depths of water. I've never been much of a social media person. Doing the videos, it's really time consuming, and you have to do something that's a little bit interesting, a little bit different. The water problem.
Is it about the V12s?
Yeah, it's about the V12. So basically, what we were talking about was that, remember where your air filters are in the car and don't drive through deep water, which is pretty straightforward. And this is not an Aston Martin thing, by the way. This is to do with, you know, BMW M3s and M5s, their air filters are low. There's lots of manufacturers.
Tend to think air filters are at the top.
Yeah, well, if you've got a Land Rover, or a Toyota Hilux or something, but sports cars, you know, sport engineers will design a car and you'll find that probably air filters are the last thing to be thrown in on the computer, wherever they're putting the engine together and all the rest of it. So all we did was want to make people aware, because the last thing I want is to have that phone call from someone saying, "I've just driven through deep water," and I'm thinking, "Here we go, this is going to cost you."
Because we've got so much flooding.
It's going to cost a fortune, yeah. And what can we do to prevent that? How can we help owners of cars and remind them of what's going on? So, and the important thing we just said was to remember was that the water might not look very deep, but when you drive through it at speed, and those front tyres are so wide, they act like a wall. So they push the water forwards, and at the same time, of course, the water level rises. And then all you need is a car to come the other way, and the water level will probably increase again, maybe double what you're constantly doing, and it's just one big, you know, inhale of water. Now, the air filters are in a box. And yes, that box does have a valve on it, a bit like a snorkel to stop water going in. But there's only so much water that can handle before it will flood and your engine will suck the water in. It's game over. You just don't want to be doing that.
You don't want to do that.
I mean, there's so many cars being written off because of it, and that's the last thing we want. The next one I'd like to do is actually talking about the annual servicing and just going through with people and saying, look, this is an annual service, but actually you should be looking at X, Y, and Z as well.
That's the point. So let's talk about X, Y, and Z. Hmm. What do you think is a weak area of these VH cars that you need to look at? When I come to mind, I remember going to a dealership, to my car for service, and the rear cradle for the rear axle.
Yeah, subframe on the back of the Vantage.
I couldn't believe how rusty.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Yeah.
This wasn't an old car.
No. Yeah, no.
Is that a weak area?
It depends where the car's lived, I think. So I could give you an example of a car that we dragged down from Aberdeen, and that was the worst one we've seen. Whereas a car that's lived in the city in an underground garage, probably not so bad. So it's a weak area. They can start to look quite scrappy under there. But it's not an out of the way thing to put right. You know,
looks worse than it is, is it?
Oh, they always look worse than they are, but equally you want it to look nice too. So, taking the subframe off, blast it, powder coat it, put it back together. We can do the same with the components. And you can make them, you can just freshen them up. And again, going forward, we're talking earlier on about, main dealers independent and how the servicing schedules are changing with what we're doing. Well, you can only ever do a light restoration kind of work, if that's what you want to call it, on the Vantages and what have you, because, obviously the bodies are aluminium, they're bonded, and apart from the usual paintwork sort of bubbles on the doors, they're relatively bulletproof in that regard. But the underneath, really, I mean, it's probably one of the most major jobs we're doing at the moment is subframe restorations on the back of the cars. Restoration is a bit of a heavy word.
Are there any other weak points that we should note? Not particularly.
No, I mean, DB9 diff, the diff oil changes, I'd bang on about that a little bit, because the DB9s, they do make a little bit of a rumble. So that's a bit of a talking point. Vantage rear subframes, yeah, okay, that's a talking point. I have to say, if we're selling, roughly speaking, 200 cars a year, we get very little trouble with them. They're so good. They're so good. Anything that goes wrong with them electrically is usually something rather silly. I was watching the latest Grand Tour, Richard Hammond had got a 2005 DB9 Volante, and the usual Jeremy Clarkson kind of thing. He'd put some sort of camping roof thing on it and all the rest of it, and they're going to drive it through the Sahara. And I must admit, I looked at it and I thought, oh, good luck with that, because that's a really difficult thing. But of course, I couldn't help but giggle. I said to the lads, we've got to watch it, because we were watching all the faults come up on the dashboard. And I was like, yeah, I know what that is. And he had there was one part of it where he said, the dashboard, it's telling me all these different things all at once. But we know that's probably just one problem. And yet the dashboard's just going absolutely nuts. But it'll be one problem causing all of that.
Yeah.
That was kind of an interesting thing to watch.
I guess you have to do a considerable investment every year as a company into keeping up to date with the latest Aston Martin technology and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So we were very fortunate when we started out to be able to buy the diagnostic equipment from Aston Martin. And funnily enough, we're at that point now where we want to step up and do the next level. So we're just starting. We're doing some DB11 servicing work, but the Aston Martin diagnostic equipment that we need, we're actually in the process of talking to Aston Martin about. So watch this space. That's our next thing.
Okay. If somebody's new to Aston Martin, they write their first Aston Martin, and perhaps one as a daily driver, what do you a reasonable daily driver? What would you point them?
Cool, that's a big question. I mean, look, cars are so personal. What one person loves, somebody else will hate, and depending on what kind of driving they're doing, and all the rest of it. I mean,
I say a daily driver. I mean, daily for Aston, if you like. Yeah.
I was getting ribbed because my daily driver was an XJ220, and some of the people from Silverstone Auctions, who are quite local, were kind of laughing in the pub at me, saying, "Yeah, well, John keeps running around in this Jag," which I had for a period back in 2000 and 2008 and 2009. So it's all about It's so individual, isn't it? You know, we're all a bit car crazy. What flicks your switch?
It's not a rational purchase. It's an emotional one.
Oh, well, God, right, yeah.
It? And as you're talking an Aston Martin, you're going,
You buy it because you love it.
Yeah.
You know, we deal with all sorts of different people that will, might be a second, third car. It might be their only car, you know, and then there's the whole, where do I live? You know, I live in London, but, you know, I'm in an underground car park. Can I trickle charge it? Can I do this? Can I do that? It's almost not a question for me to answer because it's so individual and tailored for everybody's own, you know, wants and needs and all the rest of it. There's no right or wrong with any of it. I mean, just, you know, life's short, be as daft as you want to be, you know?
I like that. Just be daft.
Yeah, I couldn't give two hoots, honestly. You know, you buy a car and someone says, oh, you can't drive that. It hasn't got any miles on it. What? Life's for living, right? You know, if you're lucky enough to go and buy a DB9 GT and you wrap it in cotton wool and it stays in your garage and you snuff it and you're knocking on the door and is it St. Michael or St. Peter? I forget which way around it is. Says to you, St. Peter, he says, you lucky boy. You know, you had that DB9 GT. What was it like to drive? Well, I didn't drive it. I couldn't have driven that. You know, what's it for? Right. For me, I drive it until the wheels fall off, rebuild it and start again.
Where should I bring it to be rebuilt?
Oh, well, yeah, indeed. But I mean, you know, so, and again, we talked about classic cars. So I'm out buying a DB5. I've got 3 lever arch files to look through. The Speedo might say it's done 72,000 miles. Who cares if it has or if it hasn't? I doubt very much. It's probably done 172,000. It doesn't matter. And it's back to the history. It's back to the files. The Speedo is utterly irrelevant. It could have been to the moon and back, and it's been stripped and rebuilt. Don't worry about it. Doesn't matter.
Where do you see, we're at the beginning of 2024, where do you see McGurk performance cars going a year ahead, 2 years ahead? Any grand plans, any ambitions? Steady she goes.
A great question.
Selling great cars?
Yeah, I think that last year was quite a rocky year. And again, from a business kind of, you know, head on my shoulders, I'm looking at this year and we want stability. I think everybody, any business owner this year, everybody wants stability. Interest rates, I think we know where we're going to be with that. We're just hoping that world peace can suddenly be achieved. I think that's another thing on the horizon. Everyone seems to be losing their minds at the moment. But that aside, head down. We want to keep pushing with the workshop, which is becoming an animal of a part of the business to run. At some point, I don't know, we might need a bit more space because we're pushing the boundaries of our showroom as well. So, who knows?
How long you been at this show?
We've been here since 2007. Originally, the building that we're in now has gone from being everything that we had to just being workshop. And the showroom, which is another 8,000 square feet. In all honesty, there are times when I could probably do with doubling the size of the showroom, really, but easier said than done.
So you're in the middle of England. Where do your customers come from? All over the shop?
All over. So what's interesting with the servicing side of things is we'll actually have people that bring their cars to us from the south of Spain, the south of France. And it sounds nuts, but the cost of having it serviced over there is huge. The network isn't great, and there's not that much in the way of sales over there, I wouldn't imagine. It's cheaper for them to...
probably expertise either.
Oh, indeed. But it's cheaper for them to put the car on a lorry and send it up to us for us to service it and turn around and send it back than it is for them to have it serviced down there, which is nuts, yeah. All over the UK, obviously we've got courtesy cars we lend to people, we've got local hotels we put people in and all the rest of it. It's a great excuse. We talked about people not driving their cars. And when it comes to servicing, we are a great excuse to get in your car and drive it here, have some fun.
It's a lovely area, isn't it?
Oh, the roads around here are great, yeah.
Yeah.
Again, it's just all part of the ownership experience.
All right, John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been a delight, and I hope to see you at the Aston Martin Festival in August 24.
Indeed, you will.
John, thank you very much.
Thanks.
You're listening to the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast. Discover more about the story of Aston Martin, the cars, the people, the history, with the Aston Martin Heritage Trust. You're always welcome to visit us at our museum in Oxfordshire, so find out more via amht.org.uk.